Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here today for the first plenary session of this World Science Forum 2019 here in Budapest. My name is Olivier Descibaud. I'm a science journalist, editor, and co-founder of a new media, a pure player in Geneva, dedicated to science, technology, and health, and called Heidi.news. So if you're getting bored by the discussion, have a look on this on your mobile. No, don't do this, right? But I'm also a physicist, and I remember those days when I was a student at school. During an exercise, I had to produce a hologram. And I was totally fascinated by this possibility to put a 3D object on a two-dimensional glass window plate. And also fascinated by this ability to look, kind of look around this object from different view, different angles. A bit like ethics, actually. But apart from that, what is the link to today's session? Actually, there are two. And the first one is that the inventor of holography was a Hungarian scientist named Denis Gabor, who won the Nobel Prize in 1971 for his work. And he grew up here in Budapest, where we are. And the second thing is that, and maybe the most important thing is that, Denis Gabor was also famous for being one of the figures of the so-called technocratic movement. And I'm sure most of you have heard about this famous Gabor's law, which he himself was describing as one of the fundamental laws of any society based on techniques. And in a nutshell, it goes, what can be made will be made. So now we live in an era where techniques not only refers to mechanics or electronics or robotics, and actually this would be also interesting for our session today, but also to life sciences. So in that later field too, what can be made will be made. And let me take just one very obvious example. You all remember these twin babies last year in China that have been, which genomes have been edited with CRISPR technology. This, albeit a very large part, if not the entire scientific community, was asking not to use CRISPR to edit human embryos. However, again, it could have been made, and it has been made, to the surprise, of course, of the entire field at the time. So this brings us to the theme, to the thematic of today, and to the question that is being asked here. Are there ethical limits to what science can achieve or should pursue? Of course, this is a very general question, and one can hide behind this one many others. Like, for example, where does the individual scientist's responsibility start and end in doing research with respect to the responsibilities of a society as a whole? Or another one, is there knowledge that is unethical to possess or to want to possess? Well, to answer those questions, we are lucky today to have five very distinguished speakers for us to talk about this and with us, which I will present you in a minute. But before that, I'll try to do a small experiment with you, an ethical experiment, if I can say. And this is actually asking you to answer this question. And for that, we have a tool called Slido. So it's very easy. You probably all have a smartphone. So I kindly ask you to take it, to log in to the Wi-Fi of the conference. The Wi-Fi is mentioned just there. So the network is called WSF 2019. And the password is HERN Academy with capital H, capital A. And once you're logged in to the Wi-Fi, I ask you to just type Slido, slido.com, on any browser. And once you've done that, you must enter a hashtag. And the hashtag is very simple, it's H541. And once you've done all this, if all of you do it, we'll have a representation of your responses immediately appearing on the screen here. Right? So I'll let you do that while I shortly present the first speaker. And actually, I'm asking you this question now, and also at the very end of the session today. And we will see if the session has changed your mind towards this question. Right, so we see the answer slowly appearing. So while you do this,
Let me introduce you for the first lecture of this plenary session. Margaret Hamburg, who we heard yesterday evening already, but today morning she will be telling us in half an hour what she thinks of this question. Margaret Hamburg is the chair of the board of the AAAS in the United States. Mrs. Hamburg, please come on stage.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid I didn't have a chance to vote, though. But in any case, distinguished colleagues and friends, it's a great honor to be here with you at the World Science Forum and in this beautiful city of Budapest. This year's meeting theme, Science, Ethics, and Responsibility, is certainly an important and timely focus for our discussions. This 2019 conference also is an opportunity for us to recognize and celebrate the 1999 UNESCO World Conference on Science, which represented the first gathering of international organizations and governments from around the world to develop a new social contract for science in the 21st century. And as the president of the World Science Forum 2019, Professor Laszlo Lovath, has noted, it's a welcome chance for us to reinforce our commitment towards the responsible and ethical use of scientific knowledge and to present the emerging challenges scientists and policymakers are facing in this new era. Only two decades have passed from that 1999 meeting, but the world has changed in dramatic ways. The advances in science and technology have been breathtaking, bringing remarkable opportunities to make a positive difference in all our lives and for the planet that we share. Many would say that we're in the golden age of science. Undoubtedly, science undergirds almost everything we do, from the mundane tasks of daily living to addressing some of the largest and most pressing challenges before us, from poverty to disease to food and water security to energy sustainability, climate change, and so much more. In fact, science is and will remain at the core of our collective work to meet essential goals: public health, environmental stewardship, the education of our children, economic stability, and our very safety and security. This gathering, the World Science Forum, provides an opportunity for those of us who work in science and care deeply about the scientific enterprise itself to examine where we are and to chart a course for the future. And as we do, we must fully recognize that the activities of science, as well as their critical applications, unfold within a much broader context. Coming together here, I believe that we've all been charged to think about the increasing importance of the ethical considerations that underlie decisions about the conduct, funding, utilization, or communication of scientific research in an era of transformative technological, environmental, and social developments. Appropriately, we're being asked to think big and think hard. This morning's session poses the question of whether there are ethical limits to what science can achieve or should pursue. And I don't pretend to be able to answer that question, but I do think it merits our serious attention and deliberation. And I very much look forward to the discussion and insights of the distinguished panel who will follow my remarks this morning. I come to this discussion as a physician scientist and career public health professional. I am not a trained ethicist, so in some ways I'm an unlikely choice to launch this panel. But a lack of formal training doesn't mean that I haven't had to grapple with issues of scientific ethics and responsibility. In fact, most of my professional career has gone forward at that often precarious intersection of science, medicine, ethics, law, and politics. My engagement around science and ethics has taken many forms. I guess first, way back in the days when I was actually taking care of patients and dealing with concerns such as appropriate treatment or choices for the end of life. And then when I was doing clinical research. But the truly weighty challenges arose a short time later when I found myself in substantial leadership roles, making hard program and policy decisions every day. As Health Commissioner of New York City, I addressed terrible discrimination against people living with HIV/AIDS and devastating inequities in care, services, and inclusion in our poorest communities. As Assistant Secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and then later at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a foundation dedicated to reducing the threats of weapons of mass destruction, I worked on creating public health preparedness programs against catastrophic threats, including strategies to address domestic terrorism and to limit or prevent deliberate or unintentional misuse of available or emerging technologies. This included a focus on how to provide responsible oversight of so-called dual-use technologies, such as synthetic biology and genetic engineering, that have the potential for so much good, but also could be used in ways that cause serious harm, which quickly led to issues of ethics, science, and responsible stewardship. I've also been commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the government agency responsible for protecting public health by ensuring the safety, efficacy, and quality of drugs and medical devices, as well as the safety of the food supply. Almost every day, we struggled with difficult questions that involved balancing risks and benefits, determining how much risk was acceptable and for whom, and whether experimental yet unproven products should be made available in a crisis or for those with no other options. Some of the most basic, seemingly routine decisions of our work, such as whether to approve a drug or not, often raised hard questions of ethics and science. What happens if you approve something too early before you can assess the full range of risks and then bad things happen, versus waiting longer to study it further, but all the while people who might benefit from it cannot access it, and again, bad things happen. Currently, I have the responsibility of serving as co-chair of a World Health Organization expert advisory committee on developing global standards for governance and oversight of human genome editing. The committee has been asked to examine the scientific, ethical, social, and legal challenges associated with human genome editing. These are weighty issues, and they surely require one to think about whether there are ethical limits to what science can achieve or should pursue. Which brings me back to the question we're being asked this morning. It's not an easy one, nor a straightforward one. And I think it is really more about trying to identify and think about the critical elements and perspectives on that question, rather than thinking that there is one right answer. So where to begin? Clearly, at least in my view, we must start with recognizing the unique and extraordinary value of science. The scientific endeavor is an iterative journey that goes forward with various stops and starts along the way. Hypotheses are formed and tested, new ideas and new knowledge are generated. Much of the work goes forward in a step-like fashion, with one thing building upon another. Sometimes, though, there are unexpected findings that can completely reshape the path forward. And there can be new findings and understandings that suddenly transform whole arenas of scientific work. Significantly, these breakthroughs can also have a transformative impact on society and how society thinks about science. Looking at the landscape of science today, the number and range of science and technology breakthroughs is truly remarkable. This is an amazing moment in history. Take genome editing, for example. Almost two centuries ago, Gregor Mendel documented the inheritance of certain traits in peas and began to define fundamental laws of genetics. Since those early observations, a series of advances have brought us to the point where we can now not only map genomes of organisms, but we can have increasingly precise tools to edit and alter them. The evolving CRISPR technology to edit genes offers huge opportunities in many realms, notably in the treatment and prevention of disease, but also in the improvement of agricultural product yields, the nutritional and other quality of plant and animal products, greener fuels, and much, much more. Generally, these advances have been welcomed for the benefits they can provide. Strikingly, human germline genome editing, on the other hand, raises a whole other set of concerns, as it involves the actual alteration of the hereditary material so that changes will be passed on from generation to generation. Such a capability has made headlines, as we heard this morning already, and is generating much discussion in scientific policy and media circles. As many of you know, it was brought into sharp focus when the Chinese scientist He Jiankui announced a year ago that he had created the first gene-edited babies. The announcement was met with widespread condemnation and concern that the clinical application in humans of such germline editing was premature, outpacing both the knowledge of safety and efficacy of the technique and the establishment of the ethical and social consensus for this kind of work to go forward. Nonetheless, the possibility of human germline editing has brought us from that early work on peas to the possibility of actually rewriting the script of human life, of changing heredity in profound and lasting ways. Without a doubt, the chance to harness advances in science and technology to make a positive difference in the world is compelling and very real. But we must also acknowledge that these new discoveries and technology-driven trends are disrupting norms in major ways and raising questions and concerns that we all must address. Advances in gene editing is one example. Computer technology, artificial intelligence, and machine learning is another, with boundless and exciting potential applications that will improve our lives. However, as with concerns surrounding certain applications of genome editing, the prospect of driverless cars, drones, facial recognition, and other forms of automation are generating new resentments and anxieties about appropriate applications of science and technology and how to wield their powers responsibly. The pace of discovery in these realms is incredible, and the possibilities they could unlock are unfathomable, but they are raising difficult, sweeping questions about ethics and privacy, the future of work and the workforce, and perhaps even what it means to be human. As we seek to harness the most value and promise from these innovations, we must also have the foresight to plan and avoid potentially harmful, unintended consequences. And as we grapple with such challenges of science, ethics, and responsibility, we must also recognize the broader context in which science occurs, how it is understood, and how it is applied. Yes, we must celebrate and support science, with all the remarkable breakthroughs being witnessed in our understanding of how things work and all the dazzling new discoveries. But as this science goes forward, we cannot ignore the evolving environment in which scientists must conduct this vital work. The world is changing around us in dramatic, sometimes concerning ways. And let me mention just a few further trends that are on my mind. Perhaps first and foremost is the growing climate of skepticism about science and the use of evidence. Frankly, I'm not quite sure how to describe what to call this condition that we find ourselves in, but there can be no doubt that we've entered a new era of so-called fake news, alternative facts, and a disdain or outright rejection of expertise. Ironically, the Oxford Dictionary now has an official entry for this phenomenon, post-truth. And the term was so much used that their word of the year just a few years ago was post-truth. The dictionary defines post-truth as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. But for those of us committed to science, it's hard to understand the outright dismissal of knowledge and neglect of evidence. Public figures in many countries are scorning scientific findings, enabling policy and decision-making which doesn't reflect the best possible science, and fostering a public distrust of science experts and expertise. Some media outlets, sadly, may fuel both the skepticism of science as well as the dissemination of false information, fake news. Whether this concerns climate change or vaccination or the safety of the food supply, we have seen the real-world harm of such approaches. At a time when science and society faces so many critical challenges, we must strive for better ways to ensure that the value of scientific evidence, reasoning, and dispassionate analysis can prevail. We cannot afford to lose the potency of science, but we must also strive to better align the value of science with the values of society. The good news is that in many public opinion polls, including one recent international survey, scientists remain among the most respected members of society. Nonetheless, trust and confidence in scientific findings and support for scientific funding has shown weakness in some worrisome ways. And it's at the perilous interface of science, ethics, politics, and practice where some of the most pronounced fault lines are starting to emerge. It's increasingly clear that science and scientists must engage in broader ways. Yes, to be understood and supported by the public and policymakers, but also to enable a better focus on problems that really matter to people and in ways that will make a difference. The ivory tower image of scientists cannot endure. Scientists cannot aspire to be all-knowing above the fray. Frankly, today, the scientific community must open our arms to the wider community of thinkers, doers, and decision makers. We must move beyond the old tropes and traditions of scholarly academia to engage the public in new ways. Scientists must listen and learn, not just with other scientists, but from the larger society that they serve and from the communities where they live and work. And in the domains where scientific advances appear to be outpacing society's ability to grasp or grapple with its implications, we should not accept that as just a fact of life, an inevitability of the nature of scientific progress in our modern world. Instead, across disciplines, sectors, communities, we must broaden the conversation. We must engage earlier and in new ways, and we must find a path to achieve a broader societal consensus and shared responsibility to better guide science towards a common good. And that brings me to another issue that I wanted to address, and that concerns the common good and our modern world. I'm increasingly concerned that we find ourselves in a world of growing nationalism at a time when so many of the problems before us demand global solutions. As a pursuit, science is a global enterprise. Science has never limited itself to national borders, and today the need for international collaboration is more pronounced than ever. Nonetheless, the scientific community faces disturbing new political pressures that we must work to resist and to reverse. This becomes even more important as we think about the intersection of ethics and science. I want to underscore here the importance of our work together and the importance of cooperation, collaboration, and trust. I work a lot on infectious disease threats where the importance of global strategies is really pretty obvious. We all understand that national boundaries do not stop infectious disease, but less obvious sometimes is how nations are organized and governed in terms of science and public health can be critically important in preparing for, fighting against, and perhaps even preventing serious, potentially catastrophic outbreaks of disease. And even more important is how nations work together towards shared goals. And for the most part, national boundaries do not stop the spread of scientific knowledge and practice. And in this case, this is a very good thing. But the attitude, oversight, and support for science in different nations does affect scientific productivity, as well as the responsible ethical stewardship of that science and its application. This is vitally important for the future of science. And let me add here that gatherings such as this World Science Forum represent one important mechanism, one kind of bridge among many, to help us overcome artificial and unhelpful divides. Of course, as we meet today, other major ethical, social, and political shifts are also underway that affect how we think about and undertake science. I know that in many parts of the world, including my own country, the United States, there's a deepening appreciation for the need for greater diversity, inclusion, and equity in the work of science and its institutions. And this is important as well. In many ways, and for many reasons, certain groups are and have always been disenfranchised in ways that harm well-being and prevent people from fulfilling their potential. Moreover, this affects how science is done and who benefits from it, and in fact, threatens the robustness and the future of our overall scientific endeavor. So we must ask ourselves hard questions and work thoughtfully toward the kind of change that can better address evolving social realities and help us better align the issues of science, ethics, and responsibility. In addition, if we want to continue to advance science in ways that are both productive and embraced, then we must recognize that while there's a potentially endless series of scientific questions that might be asked about the world and how things work, science is not just about asking questions and acquiring knowledge. It's also about finding ways to harness the power of science for the common good, to improve the human condition, and to make the world a better, safer place. I suspect that this is a sentiment that almost every one of us in this room would strongly share: science in the service of humanity. Yet undeniably, we've seen that applications of science and technology have not always benefited society or the planet. Certainly, some of the evolving technologies of warfare, things like napalm, landmines, and the atomic bomb. But many other examples too, such as the environmental toll of our carbon-intensive lifestyles, the contamination of water supplies because of chemicals and pesticides used in modern agriculture, or the loss of effective antibiotics because of overuse and the development of resistance. Often within the scientific community, and sometimes beyond, there's a sense that the pace of advance today is so rapid and the breakthrough so momentous that it's virtually impossible for the public and policymakers to keep up with what it means and how it will be used. There's a belief that it's inevitable, that new science will flow considerably before society can figure out how best to navigate it, both its pace and its consequences. And correspondingly, that somehow the necessary work, including the necessary set of players to think through the ethical considerations of the research and its application, will have to drag behind. But the truth is, we cannot always be playing catch-up, and we certainly can't allow ethical concerns to be marginalized or an afterthought. If we care about our shared futures, and if we care about the responsible and accountable stewardship of science, then we all must get in the same boat, and we all must be pulling in the same direction. Many years ago, in the midst of the Civil War, a terrible time of turmoil in the United States, President Abraham Lincoln observed that we must, and I quote, "think anew and act anew." In his annual message to Congress, back in 1862, he noted that we can only succeed by concert. It is not, can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? The world today demands that we think and act differently, and that we do better. The scientific community must evolve to meet these modern realities if it's to continue its path of growth and progress to address our most pressing problems. We must act in concert with society in far deeper, broader, and more meaningful ways. We must identify and acknowledge the ethical concerns that may be raised by our work. We must take on the mantle of responsibility for appropriate scientific conduct and stewardship of our work. And we must strive to ensure that a broader set of questions gets asked and answered, and that a larger set of stakeholders sit in that boat with us. We are living in a time of great possibility, but with grave dangers as well. Huge threats loom, and there are choppy waters ahead. Without a doubt, the complex realities of modern science demand greater understanding, engaged deliberations, and hopefully more consensus about how best to move forward. Solutions will require extraordinary levels of cooperation, collaboration, and science. I do believe that the scientific community has a very special responsibility in helping to identify and define solutions. And together, the scientific community, the many individuals and organizations that are in fact represented in this room, can be force multipliers to ensure meaningful, sustainable action. Together, we can help to reduce risks, to harness the best of science in the service of people. As we navigate uncharted waters, evidence must be our North Star, and integrity, not ideology, must be our driver. Moreover, at a time of so much divisiveness and polarization in many of our countries and in the global community, we must focus on how science can bring together people, ideas, and solutions from across real and artificial borders, including scientific disciplines, sectors of society, backgrounds, ideologies, geographies, and traditions. But as I've underscored already, science alone is not the answer. Clearly, we do need new models of governance and for the oversight of scientific research and its application. To continue the slightly cumbersome maritime metaphor, we must think about who and how the ship is steered, who provides the needed input for navigation, who decides when to accelerate, and when we need to slow for hazards or when the waters begin to churn. In our work on the WHO Expert Advisory Committee on Human Genome Editing, we see the development of a governance framework for oversight and responsible stewardship as our most central and essential task. But we're still early in our thinking and in the development of our ideas and proposals, so you won't be hearing any breaking news from me today. But I will say that the committee fully appreciates the pressing need to examine the scientific, ethical, social, and legal challenges associated with human genome editing. And as the development of this evolving tool moves forward rapidly, we have a responsibility to be focused and efficient, yet we need to deliberate and take time to gather and review a lot of information about current activities, existing regulatory frameworks, to engage stakeholders, to identify the highest priority ethical concerns, and to weigh risks and benefits. Following our first meeting, we issued several recommendations, including a clear statement that it would be, quote, irresponsible at this time for anyone to proceed with clinical applications of human germline genome editing, and requesting regulators not to allow human germline editing in the clinical context. We also announced first steps to establish a registry for relevant research. The committee stressed that as the science of human genome editing moves forward, an effective and just governance framework will need to maximize potential benefits while minimizing potential harms, and we've laid out a set of principles to inform and direct the work of the committee, including transparency, inclusiveness, responsible stewardship of science, fairness, and social justice. These principles will be of critical importance in ensuring responsible use of genome editing technology, use in ways that will reflect true public understanding and acceptance, a commitment to apply this science in the service of the betterment of society, both improving individual and public health, and such that the benefits of genome engineering are shared equitably. We have much work to do, But I know that our work will benefit from the work and perspectives of many, including that of this distinguished panel that we'll be hearing from this morning, and more broadly, the work of the World Science Forum. So with that, I will close my remarks so that we can all hear from the panel. So thank you for your time and attention, and thank you for all your dedication to science and your commitment to ensure that science can both flourish and fully serve the needs of people and the planet. Thank you.